This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. More and more criminal justice depends on forensic evidence and especially on DNA, the near miraculous ability to conclusively identify individuals from the saliva on a cigarette butt or a drop of blood is often decisive in court, and after all the publicity, juries are coming to expect it. But some questions are beginning to be asked. The DNA evidence processed by the crime lab in Houston, Texas, has been under investigation for 6 months now. One conviction has already been overturned. There have been problems reported in crime labs from Montana to Arizona. Most people don't argue the science behind DNA. The problems come in when humans misinterpret the data or lose the evidence or mix up the suspect's DNA with somebody else's. As we continue our series on Law and Order, we're going to get a sense of life in the crime lab. Are these mistakes aberrations, or do they speak to a systemic problem? Also, what safeguards are in place to prevent human error? How are labs regulated? Should they be tied to police departments, or should they be independent? Later on this hour, we'll talk about life after prison with somebody who was exonerated after DNA evidence proved he was not guilty. If you'd like to join our conversations, give us a phone call. Our number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from her office in Houston is Marie Meunier, chief of the Trial Bureau for Harris County in Houston, Texas. She supervises the county's prosecutors and has been overseeing the investigation into the DNA cases, and it's good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Very briefly, can you tell us how this came to light?
Well, in November, there was a media expose of some individual cases that were reviewed and some problems in our local Houston Police Department crime lab was brought to the attention of the police department as well as our office. After we found out about realized that we may have a problem that was not just isolated but that may have involved the entire crime lab, we began our investigation into all cases of convictions where we had used any DNA evidence at all in prosecuting people.
Sounds like a nightmare.
Yes, because in Harris County, we have a very large jurisdiction. We handle over 100,000 cases a year here now. And the crime lab began doing DNA work back in 1992. So it's been a painstaking effort to try to just, first of all, identify the cases that had Houston Police Department DNA evidence in them, and then to have them reviewed by prosecutors, and then to identify those cases where we're going to ask that the evidence be retested.
Yeah, you're a prosecutor yourself. Have you had to review are any of your own cases involved here?
Well, there's a few cases that I've seen come through that I handled as years ago, but I'm not reviewing any of those. They're being reviewed by other people.
Now, who does the crime lab report to in Houston? Who's involved here?
Well, it's under the City of Houston Police Department. It's not a county crime lab. We have another crime lab that's associated with our medical examiner's office, and that's run by the county. But this particular lab was run by the City of Houston, so it would be the police chief, the City of Houston Police Department chief, the mayor, the city council.
Now, your investigation isn't finished here, and there's a couple of grand juries that are also looking into this, so we're nowhere close to being anywhere conclusive on this. But as I'm sure you know, I mean, some of the allegations involved here are that, you know, there's an awful lot of pressure to come up with convictions, and that that was a contributing factor to this problem.
Well, that allegation has been lodged at us. I frankly don't buy into that. I think that the crime lab's investigation and the testing that they did was independent. And in fact, in reviewing some of these cases, I've come across many cases where the defendants were excluded by the DNA evidence and the case was either no-billed or dismissed after we received DNA results. So it's certainly, on those cases, obviously we weren't putting pressure on anybody to include someone in a DNA match. So there are cases being reviewed where the DNA originally done by that agency exonerated defendants.
And some other people, as again I'm sure you know, are saying, look, there's an inherent conflict of interest here. How can you people who rely on this evidence, sort of investigate? Again, they don't report directly to you, but in a way it's your own shop.
Well, no, the crime lab is not our shop. We, I guess if you had to, if I looked at it, gave a hard look at what our office has done, is that I think that we were probably naive in blindly trusting what the people at the crime lab, you know, gave us, the evidence that they gave us and what we believe to be good scientific basis for those opinions. We're certainly not naive anymore, and I think probably will question any scientific evidence that's brought to us and make sure that we understand more about it and don't assume that things are done always you know, accurately in the way they should be done.
As I understand it, this crime lab had some funding problems. The facility itself was not the greatest in the world. The roof leaked, and I'm sure that's probably the most famous leaking roof in all of Houston at this point.
That certainly didn't help any. That was they moved in, the police department moved into a building, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago, and evidently that roof's been leaking for a long time, and the crime lab, unfortunately, was on the top floor, so that did not help matters any at all.
Well, in as you look at all of this, there is that other county crime lab. Have you come to any conclusions about, you know, how things should be handled in the future?
Well, I'm a proponent for accreditation of labs, and I before this, I really didn't, I didn't realize that there was such a thing, and that shows, you know, kind of my ignorance. And I think that laboratories should meet a minimum standard to assure to what degree that can assure the public that they are operating under guidelines that have been established by a group of people, scientific people in their field that that help assure the quality of their work. So I think laboratories should be monitored by some agency to ensure as much as they can that they're doing the tests the way they should be done, and that they're putting out a good product and that they're reliable. Now, always there's always the factor of human error. I don't think you can ever get around that in anything. But I think a crime lab that works without some aura of reliability and some standards that they can go by, I think you're probably just asking for trouble.
As we mentioned, one case has been overturned already. Can you give us any idea of what the potential for these cases is?
Well, it's really too soon to tell. We've got about 213 cases so far that we've identified for retesting. We've gotten results back in about, I want to say about 21 cases that have been retested. One of those is the young man that is out of prison now. Another one is problematic because the original evidence was not didn't have any DNA on it, and they tested extracted DNA and that had degraded. So, you know, the examination, I think, at the police department is going into not just the laboratory test, but also how evidence was stored and handled. And it's raised a lot of questions and gotten us, I think, here in the Houston area involved in trying to make sure that if they start the DNA lab up again, that everything that can be done to assure the quality of it will be done. And then our review is to make sure that, you know, if we did introduce some evidence that was not accurate, that we find out about it and that we correct that mistake.
It's going to be a lot of work. We appreciate your taking the time to speak with us today.
You're quite welcome.
Marie Mounier is chief of the Trial Bureau for Harris County, Texas, and she joined us from her office in Houston. And if you'd like to join our conversation, what questions do you have about how crime labs work or don't work? What don't you understand about DNA evidence? Our number again in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Joining us now from his office in Irvine, California, is William Thompson, a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine. And he's had a close look at some of the DNA evidence in Houston. Good of you to be with us today.
I'm glad to be with you.
Why did you look at the evidence?
I was approached by investigative reporters at Houston television station KHOU, which is the local CBS affiliate. They were investigating rumors of misconduct and bad work at the crime lab, and they asked me if I would take a look at some of the cases that they had gotten records on and let them know whether I saw any problems.
And what did you find?
I found many, many problems. I found routinely exaggerated presentation of results. I found the lab failing to follow proper procedures, such as failing to use proper controls. I found, in reviewing about 9 cases total, I found 3 cases where the lab personnel made outright misrepresentations of the scientific findings.
We heard Ms. Mounier say she didn't think prosecutorial pressure or the culture of trying to get people into court and convict them was responsible here. Do you agree?
Not entirely. I mean, I saw instances that led me to believe, at least in one case, there was evidence that the prosecutor knew about problems in the lab work and was making efforts to cover them up, and so I do think that Ms. Mounier's office is involved in this scandal. I think deputies in her office are material witnesses, if nothing else, to the lab misconduct. And I think in some cases they may actually have been implicated in the misconduct. So I actually think it would be appropriate for her office to recuse itself from this investigation. And I can't understand why they haven't done so.
You have also testified before one of the grand juries that's investigating, at least one. You may have testified both. I don't know.
Both, actually.
Yeah, and
you can't
talk about that. That would be against the law. There's obviously, these are grand jury investigations that are going on at this point without prosecutorial help.
I think it highlights one of the problems that we have in our current system of criminal justice, and in that there's no effective mechanism that exists right now to investigate these crime lab scandals, other than the district attorney's office, which may itself have been involved in the scandal. And so what we really need, some sort of independent mechanism, such as an innocence commission, or in the British Commonwealth, they often appoint royal commissions to look into such incidents. But we've had no effective mechanism in the United States to look into these cases where there's a miscarriage of justice and try to determine what caused it and what needs to be done to correct the problem.
I understand after your grand jury testimony, you were able to go see the crime lab in Houston that's at question. Have conditions there improved?
Well, the physical facilities are still, I should say the lab appears to have pretty good equipment. I mean, it appears that their basic equipment budget is probably adequate. The problem with the leaking roof is just absurd. They had
still leaking.
Yes, there was still water dripping from the roof when I was there. The lab personnel had rigged this elaborate Rube Goldberg contraption consisting of tarpaulins and garden hoses to divert the leaking water away from the lab benches, and they seem to have habituated and accommodated themselves to that situation. I think that they been working under poor conditions so long, they seem to have lost contact with how absurd it must look to outsiders.
We're talking about the trials that some crime labs are facing right now, and when we come back from a break, we'll expand beyond Houston and talk about systemic problems with crime labs around the country. Or is Houston aberrational? We'll also begin taking your calls. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. If you have questions about how DNA evidence is gathered, tested, and used in prosecutions or exonerations, give us a phone call. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about DNA and crime labs. You're invited to join our discussion. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is William Thompson, who's a criminology professor at the University of California, Irvine. And let's go right to the phones. Our first caller is Melissa, who joins us from Delran, New Jersey.
Hi, Mr. Thompson, Professor. I'm not sure if you can answer this question. I'm interested in the fact that Texas, along with Florida, executes more of its own state citizens than any other state. And the prosecutor from Harris County admitted that they have been, the crime lab there has been ineffective in Houston since 92. Is there a possibility that there have been actual executions of people who were innocent as a result of the faulty DNA testing?
Well, I can't say for sure, but I do know that Harris County has sent more people to death row than any other county in the United States, apparently.
Right, exactly.
More than any other state, except for the rest of Texas and Virginia. So
right.
It's a very large county in which there are an awful lot of criminal prosecutions, many of which lead to people being sentenced to death. So in light of the problems we've seen in the crime lab, I certainly think we need to look very carefully at the death penalty cases to determine whether there might have been a miscarriage of justice, and also whether these people got fair trials. I mean, even if they got the DNA test right as far as inclusion-exclusion, there still is a problem in some of these cases about overstatement or exaggeration of the results.
Right.
That needs to be examined as well.
As far as whether somebody's been executed during this period where this DNA falls, is that a separate investigation that's being conducted?
Not that I know of. As far as I know, the district attorney's office itself is the only one in a position to actually conduct that investigation, which, you know, from my point of view, is part of the problem.
Here's an email question we have from Dave Dyer. The problem with crime labs in general, he writes, is that they don't follow good scientific procedure in their tests. For example, they're presented with two samples and asked, do these match, rather than being presented with multiple samples and being asked which of any of these samples match. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think that's very true. I think that it's something that I've written about. I think that there are a lot of instances where a crime lab will get ambiguous results, and there's concern that the fact that the analysts know which results will help the investigation might influence them, perhaps unintentionally, in one direction or another. In academic laboratories, scientists try to guard against that kind of possibility by using blind procedures or by doing evidence lineups and so on. Forensic scientists generally have not adopted those procedures, and I think they would be better off if they did.
Well, joining us now from his office in Santa Ana, California, is Frank Fitzpatrick. He's the chair of the Laboratory Accreditation Board for the American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors. He's also director of the Forensic Science Lab in Orange County, California, and good of you to be with us today.
Thank you.
What are the qualifications for a certified lab?
For an accredited laboratory, they have to make an application and undergo a inspection by a group of inspectors of a accreditation manual, and this includes standards and criteria that have been adopted and have evolved since 1982.
Are all labs certified?
No. Presently, there's about 240 accredited laboratories in the United States.
Out of how many?
It's a good question. We really don't know. We estimate the numbers could be as low as 500 laboratories doing some type of forensic science to as high as 800 laboratories doing some type of forensic science.
How often are these laboratories that are accredited, how often are they audited?
They actually have an on-site inspection every 5 years, and then they have to self-disclose on an annual report every year about the condition of their quality system.
5 years seems like a long time.
It is a long time, and that's one part of the program, the laboratory accreditation program, that we are looking at very seriously right now and trying to change that so that there would be more frequent on-site inspections.
Hmm. Is it just the labs that are accredited or the people who work there, you know, that make sure that they have the proper qualifications and that sort of thing?
Well, there's actually two different programs. One is certification of forensic scientists. And that's run by a different organization, the American Board of Criminalistics. But within the accreditation program, the laboratory has to demonstrate that they have properly trained their analysts to to the methodology that they have adopted within the laboratory, that they have proven their competency before they start casework, and that they test them periodically for their proficiency in doing casework.
I wanted to ask you, and I wanted to bring Professor Thompson in on this as well. Essentially, we're dealing with, certainly with DNA, with something that's relatively new, and that's, you know, obviously the science background is there, but this can be tricky to handle. Are we just getting the, you know, ways to handle this properly in terms of processing and handling the evidence? Is that just beginning to be, addressed correctly now?
I don't think so. The DNA is unique in how it evolved in laboratories, and the quality assurance programs in accredited laboratories and laboratories that participate in the federal CODIS program are probably the most strict quality assurance standards we have in laboratories. In DNA laboratories, for instance, they do have an external inspection every other year.
Mm-hmm.
So that certainly is different than the
just regular forensic
program.
Yeah. Professor Thompson?
Well, I think accreditation is very helpful. I'm not sure it's a total solution to the problem. Accreditation standards tend to be minimum standards, not necessarily best practice standards. And it's also important to understand that accreditation looks at the lab's procedures. It's not a cross-check on the lab's work in particular cases. So even if you have an accredited lab, I think it's also important that the work done on a case-by-case basis be scrutinized by somebody to make sure that the proper procedures are being followed. I think part of the problem in Houston, I think accreditation would certainly help the Houston lab, but I think it's also necessary that there be some sort of scrutiny of the lab work in the criminal justice process.
Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is William, who's on the line with us from Hamilton, New Jersey.
Hello.
Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hello. As I had mentioned before, I just caught brief snippets of the conversation of the show dealing with errors, oversights, and working environments of the various crime labs that in question. And my comment or my question to the show is, why do not crime labs subject themselves to an outside certifying process, much akin to what hospitals, clinical labs in hospitals do with the College of American Pathology, where they subject themselves to outside overview, survey, inspection, as well as periodic blind sampling and results sent to outside labs for confirmation.
Well, let's turn to Frank Fitzpatrick, who's chair of the Laboratory Accreditation Board.
Well, I think that's exactly what the Laboratory Accreditation Board does do. We do proficiency testing of all the members of the laboratory. They're required to be proficiency tested at least once a year, DNA analysts or twice a year, and that's in every discipline that they do work. Additionally, when we have the on-site inspection, we actually do go into case files, and we see that the conclusions that they reach in case files are consistent with the science of, you know, the forensic science and the data that they have generated. So I think perhaps we don't do the on-site inspection as frequently as we should, but certainly it's much akin to what you find in the hospital environment.
Okay. William, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's go now to Sharon, and Sharon's on the line from Los Angeles.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to find out, I have a daughter who's in college, and she's interested in forensic anthropology, so at some point or another she'll probably do some time as a lab technician, and I'm wondering how all this accreditation and new procedures might affect the job opportunities in that field. Are they going to eventually just go to using non-human techniques for doing a lot of these kinds of things?
Frank Fitzpatrick, what do you think?
Anthropology, forensic anthropology, is a very labor-intensive type of examination, and I think it's not something that lends itself well to automation. It really requires the depth of experience and training that an individual has. So I think in terms of forensic anthropology, the job market's going to be there in the future.
Well, I figure doing internships and, you know, building on her career, she'll probably work in some government agency, you know, for a while before she can, you know, have a whole career based on that, is my understanding of how it works.
The typically government agencies either employ forensic anthropologists or they contract with forensic anthropologists who may have their own private business.
So those people don't come into question those types of evaluations as much as the technicians?
No, they're under scrutiny also. You know, it depends upon what type of use the information is being used for. In some instances, they do testify, and they are particularly important in the prosecution and defense of a case. And so from that standpoint, they would be scrutinized.
Well, Sharon, we wish your daughter good luck.
Thank you. Bye.
Appreciate the phone call. And Frank Fitzpatrick, we know you're busy. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Frank Fitzpatrick is the director of the Forensic Science Lab in Orange County, chair of the Laboratory Accreditation Board for the American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors. He joined us on the phone from Santa Ana in California. Still with us is William Thompson, a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine. And let's get another caller. Ray's in the line with us from New Braunfels in Texas.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to share a personal story just to kind of shed some light on how common it probably is that there are all these labs out there providing results. When I was in college, I took a job with a company, and our company was developing a procedure to test blood and urine samples for court-ordered samples, basically people that were on drugs and were going to have their kids taken away if they continue to test positive for drugs. And I was just a 18-year-old kid trying to develop a procedure under the watch of the director of the lab, a small little company. And I had known positives and known negatives, and I had to come up with a procedure of how to test for these drugs. And to make a long story short, I was having to report my findings on some samples back to courts that had results of kids getting taken away from families potentially before I was comfortable that I was able to get solid results. There was pressure on me to simply turn out the results so they could get the revenues from these courts.
Who was pressuring you, if I may ask?
It was a very small little company. I'm not going to say who it was and all that kind of stuff. But there were only like two or three people there at the company, and it was the doctor, whatever his name was, a PhD in chemistry, I believe, that was saying, you know, you need to give these results. We need to get on stream. We've got these samples coming. We've promised them. And I was saying, look, I can't even get 100% reproducibility on testing for our known positives and our known negatives. So I started backing up and saying, I'm not going to talk to the courts. I can't deal with that. And then over the course of a few weeks, a few months, I eventually said I have to quit because I'm losing sleep.
Yeah, well, I think your story is very interesting because it highlights a very important issue, which is that there can be business and institutional concerns that kind of trump scientific values, such that scientific integrity and scientific rigor get lost because of other values emerging and becoming more important.
Exactly,
and I think it can happen in private labs where there's a financial motive, and I think it can happen in government labs where the personnel are answering to police authorities as their bosses, and where there's not adequate oversight. So, I think it's something that we as a society need to look at very carefully, and think about what kind of institutional and organizational structure is most conducive to doing good science in these cases where a single result may send somebody to prison or even to death row.
Well, Ray, thanks very much.
Of course. Have a good day.
Oh, you too.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now from his office in New York City is Peter Neufeld. He's director of the Innocence Project at Cardozo Law School, and it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
Now, I know you've looked at some of the problems with labs across the country beyond Houston. What else is going on?
Well, we've had an outbreak of laboratory scandals in the last few years, unfortunately. Aside from Houston, we have a statewide scandal in Montana where the director of the crime laboratory for 20 years, who was their hair expert, the first three cases we've looked at, it turns out he was wrong on all three cases, now cleared by DNA. There may have to be an audit of 250 cases he did. Oklahoma, there was problems with serology and hair examination.
That was a couple of years ago, yeah.
Well, no, it's still ongoing because one of the people who they're relying on to do the reexaminations is someone who made 17 mistakes in another case. There is a lab scandal in Phoenix, Arizona, and they're thinking of doing an audit right now as well. The Federal Bureau of Investigation recently recognized that one of their DNA examiners for more than a year was failing to follow the required controls, and they're now going back and reexamining all of her casework. So it's a national phenomenon right now, unfortunately. And the problem is that a lot of the recommendations that have been put forward, either by people in Houston or by folks from the crime laboratory directors, are not adequate.
What should they do?
Going down the wrong street.
What should they do?
Well, you know, we have a model for this, and the model in this country is called the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act. We have a regulatory scheme that has been established for clinical science for a number of years. Number one, it's government-regulated as opposed to a voluntary accreditation program. I mean, frankly, I don't think any of us would go eat a steak if we knew that instead of having the Department of Agriculture inspect the meat, it was done by the Meatpackers Association. So, you know, you're missing that kind of government rigor in ASCLAB. More importantly, though, there is no independent auditing mechanism in ASCLAB. There's no requirement that any of the laboratories are accredited when they discover actual misconduct by a forensic scientist, bring in an outsider. I sit on the board of a medical committee here in New York City, and whenever we find an act of misconduct, we immediately bring in outsiders to peer review what happened and then conduct a forensic audit on other acts of surgery committed by the physician. That's what's done when they had the Enron scandal. That's what you folks in the press made NASA do after the shuttle crash. They couldn't do their own audit. It had to be done independently. But at crime labs, it's not done independently. You have the DA in Houston trying to run the show down there. You have in Montana the attorney general who would use this fraudulent forensic scientist, a number of prosecutions himself running the show. In Oklahoma, you have people who were discredited in the past doing the examination right now. What we need to do in forensic science is bring the same kind of rigor that we require of government, that we require of industry, that we require for clinical medicine. And if we do that, at least the public can be assured that the integrity of the product is a heck of a lot better than it is right now.
We're speaking with Peter Neufeld and Frank and with William Thompson about DNA and crime labs. We'll continue that conversation after we come back from a short break. And we'll also be talking with a man who has been exonerated on the basis of DNA evidence and talk to him about what life is like after he is released. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, an update on day-to-day life in Iraq, from water to electricity to paychecks. How are Iraqis faring and what's being done to help them rebuild their lives? Back to Baghdad tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. We're continuing our conversation about DNA and crime labs. Our guests are William Thompson, who's a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law and Society at the University of California at Irvine. And also with us is Peter Neufeld, who is director of the Innocence Project at Cardozo Law School. And let's get a phone call. Ed joins us on the line from Miami, Florida.
Hello there.
Hi there.
It's good to be with you. It's a very interesting program. I ran a major crime laboratory for about 28 years, retired in 1986 with a staff of about 82 people. I've been through some mileage myself. I've testified in about 3,200 cases, civil and criminal, mostly criminal, city, county, state, federal, and foreign countries.
And where was this crime lab? In Miami?
Miami. Dade County Crime Laboratory. The Miami crime lab closed down 30 years ago or more.
It was revived on TV, but that's another issue.
The jokes that they put on for CSI, they're just marvelous. They're so far from the truth that it's a screaming laugh. But I fully agree with the tone of most of the attitudes that have been expressed. There must be some sort of a completely independent, I presume federally funded, examination procedures for the laboratories, and there should be, you know, blank tests run through them. We are way past having only hundreds of innocent people in jail. I think it's approaching the thousands, and some states, of course, are worse than others.
So you
Virginia
think
is a standout state. I have a current murder case under underway that I've been working pro bono for about 5 years. And a woman has been convicted, and she's facing 23 years in the penitentiary for killing her husband. And she no more killed him than you did. It's the most ridiculous case I have ever worked in my life. It's gone all the way to the Supreme Court of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And I don't know its current status. I've been out of touch for a week or two.
Mm-hmm. So these problems are, in your view, not aberrational. They are systemic.
Absolutely.
Neil?
Yes?
Just to keep the record straight on this, Florida has had more people exonerated from death row than any other state in the union.
That's fine, but how many of them came out of Dade County?
That I don't know.
Well, it's interesting to me because I think that I only found two cases in 28 years, in 31 years in that lab. I think I only saw two cases in which the evidence was doctored by the police.
Okay.
And both of them I forced right down the tube.
Right. We're not necessarily talking just about doctoring evidence here. We're also talking about bad practices.
Yeah, sure.
You know, people who don't intend misconduct, but because they're sloppy or careless or fail to use procedures that are adequately rigorous, may end up making mistakes.
Absolutely. They
actually, one of the other problems that we find is, aside from those kinds of mistakes, that there was a tendency on the part of crime lab personnel, because they're part of the team, to exaggerate the probative value of the evidence, both in their reports and later on in their testimony.
True.
We've gone back over dozens and dozens of wrong convictions, and we've found that as opposed to a few rotten apples who are outright frauds, there are literally dozens of forensic scientists in almost every discipline who simply exaggerate the probative value to lead the jury toward a conviction where they might have certain hesitation.
Right, and I certainly saw evidence of that in practically every case that I examined from the Houston crime lab. So I think it's a common problem. It also highlights another problem, which is that the criminal justice system is not doing a very good job of exposing these problems when they occur. I mean, the district attorneys are standing in the way of timely discovery or disclosure of information to the defense, and defense lawyers often are not doing a very good job exposing these problems.
Well, I think we're going to have to wrap it up there because we want to move on, but it's been a fascinating conversation. Ed, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good
and William Thompson and Peter Neufeld, good of you both to join us today.
Neil, it's a pleasure.
As always. Bye-bye.
Here.
Right.
Peter Neufeld is the director of the Innocence Project at Cardozo Law School. He was with us from his office in New York City. And William Thompson was with us from his office in Irvine, California, where he's professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine.